From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was an epic day with no certain outcome. 156,000 Allied troops going ashore in Nazi-occupied Europe. 11,000 aircraft, 7,000 ships, and wave on wave of young men from the sea, from the air, on D-Day. Tomorrow marks the 70th anniversary of the big World War II Allied invasion of Europe. Young men who were 20 then are 90 now. There's an element of last salute here. This hour On Point, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Were you there? Do you know the stories from your father, grandfather, great-grandfather? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here, on June 6, 1944, Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower gave a radio address about the D-Day attack to the people of Western Europe.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies.
Here, veteran Sergio Morano, member of the 90th Infantry Division, said the mood among the men was quiet and pensive in the hours leading up to the landing.
And that day, we had a meal with everything you can think of. I says, man, this is my last supper.
My last supper, and they hit the beaches. Here's the Daily Telegraph's Cornelius Ryan.
Grim scenes on the beaches. Bursts of enemy fire ring out, and we see men fall.
And Bob Slaughter here, a member of the 29th Infantry Division, there, June 6, 1944, at Omaha Beach.
We had at least 300 or 400 yards of flat sand to cross before we could get to any kind of cover. You can't go back. The only way to go is forward. It is no option. And you just pray you're not going to get killed, you know, not going to get shot in the stomach, and you pray you don't get hit in the head. If I get hit, I hope it's in the arm or leg, or they can have my leg, they can have my arm.
Bob Slaughter, who was there on D-Day, will hear in this hour from a D-Day veteran who parachuted into France in the D-Day invasion. But first, joining me now from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, is Carlo Desti. He is a military historian and author. His books include Decision in Normandy, Eisenhower, A Soldier's Life, Patton, Genius for War. Carlos Desti, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
How old were you on D-Day, Mr. Desti?
I was not quite 8 years old, so I was a child of World War II. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I remember very well, you know, what tremendous military activity we had in the Bay Area. There was naval activity. There were Army units. There was a lot of stuff going on. We grew up in blackouts, and my dad was too old for World War II, so he worked in the Kaiser shipyards in Richmond, California, where they built the Liberty ships. So I had a sense. I wasn't really, I think, terribly aware of D-Day until much later. But certainly the war came home to me as a very young man.
You were so young, but this was a battle that we read people in the country knew was going on as it went on. Once it began, people, almost an unofficial national day of prayer, the whole country holding its breath.
Well, it was. And as the day began and as the hours progressed, the news of the invasion sort of swept across America, and it did become sort of a national day of prayer. They closed sporting events. They closed the Broadway shows. People in America flocked to churches to pray for those in the invasion. So it did become, I think, one of the most unique days, certainly in the 20th century, and if not in all of American history.
Here was the part of the message from General Eisenhower just before the invasion.
I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Carlo Desti, in that same message, General Eisenhower said, "Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely." What was at stake as this enormous armada and number of men, ships, planes went across toward Europe?
Well, what was at stake was really the future of World War II for the Allies. We had been fighting in the Mediterranean since November of 1942, but that was really a peripheral war. The war against Germany was not going to be resolved in the Mediterranean. It was going to be resolved in Europe. And in order to do that, you know, we had to invade France somewhere. And to do that, we had to pull off a successful landing. And the challenge that we faced on D-Day was absolutely colossal. It was, you know, how to plan and successfully carry out the largest amphibious operation in the history of warfare. You know, how are we going to get those 156,000 troops on D-Day in by glider, by parachute, and by sea, and against a strongly defended hostile shore? How are we going to do that while at the same time we were going to make sure that the Germans didn't know we were coming? And as a matter of fact, our own troops really didn't know where they were going until just hours before D-Day. So the challenge that Eisenhower and the planners of Operation Overlord faced was probably, I think, the greatest in military history.
There was no guarantee of victory here. I mean, we now know Eisenhower scribbled himself a note, a draft of a statement he would deliver if the D-Day invasion failed. He said, "Our landings," he goes on to say, "have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold. I've withdrawn the troops." This is a note that he never had to use. He said, "My decision to attack this time and place was based on the best information available. The troops, the air, and Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to this attempt, it is mine alone." He had prepared such a statement in case this did not work. If it hadn't, what
would
that have meant?
There's no guarantee that operation was going to succeed. And in the face of what happened, you know, Eisenhower was prepared for the chance that there could be failure. And failure was really, when we look back on it, a very real possibility. But failure was also not an option for the Allies. So if D-Day had failed, the whole course of World War II would have changed. For one thing, we could not have remounted an invasion of France until the summer of 1945. We would have lost the element of surprise. You know, part of the success of D-Day was the fact that we were able to pull off the greatest deception operation in the history of warfare, which was called Operation Fortitude, which convinced the Germans that we were going to land in the Pas-de-Calais sector of France.
This is where General Patton comes in.
Yes, and Patton was kind of used as a straw man. Patton was the Allied general that the Germans feared the most. So it would have been 1945 before we could have remounted that kind of an operation. The war then would have gone on until at least 1946. The whole landscape of Europe may very well have changed. It's very possible that the Red Army could have advanced as far as the Rhine River instead of into Berlin, where they eventually ended up when the war ended. So the possibilities for things that could have gone wrong on D-Day and the consequences of that failure, should that have happened, were almost mind-boggling. And of course, Eisenhower was extremely mindful of that possibility. On D-Day, you know, one of the problems that he encountered was the fact that communications in 1944 were just awful. Mm-hmm. It was hard to stay in touch with what was going on at the front. So for hours, he did not know, you know, whether the landings were successful. And even then, when the word started filtering in, he came to realize that the situation on Omaha Beach was dire, and that we didn't know at that early stage whether we were going to even be able to hold Omaha.
Who was going ashore on that day? Of course, it wasn't only Americans. There were beaches taken by the British. There were beaches taken by the Canadians. Among the Americans, J.D. Salinger landed on Omaha Beach with six chapters of his unfinished Catcher in the Rye in his backpack, we're told. Among the American troops, were they seasoned veterans by this point? Who was going ashore in that great number?
Some were, but a great many of them were not. This is the first time in combat. You know, what they tried to do was to sprinkle seasoned veterans, NCOs, and people who had seen combat, you know, into the invasion forces, so that there would be at least a mixture of people that had some experience of combat. But many of those young men that landed on D-Day, you know, it was their first combat. So you can just try to imagine, you know, looking back 70 years now of the terror and the feelings that must have gone through the minds of those young men. I think it's fairly safe to suggest that those that were involved and went ashore on Omaha and Utah Beach and those other beaches were young men barely out of their teens. And most of them, I think, probably thought that they were going to die that day. And those that survived were grateful for the opportunity to have their lives back, you know, after the horror of some of the things that occurred on D-Day.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about D-Day on its now 70th anniversary, the great World War II invasion of Normandy that turned the tide on Hitler in World War II. The boys who hit the beaches are now hitting 90. This may be our last big look back together. Carlo Desti is with us, American military historian, author of Decision in Normandy, Eisenhower, Patton, Warlord, A Life of Winston Churchill at War, and many more. The Daily Telegraph's Cornelius Ryan flew from a U.S. Air Force base to follow the action on that day in Normandy.
The bombers begin the invasion blow. Great air fleets hitting German defenses. Smoke bombs are used for guidance as thousands of tons of high explosives rain down, smashing Nazi transport and fortifications in preparation for the second front landings. Watch, a road junction is hit. Strategic bridge knocked out by precision bombing.
Was it frightening that day? It was completely frightening. Here's Jerry Legault, who was a captain, company commander, 1st Infantry Division, said the real fear set in when he saw the corpses of American GIs floating in the water.
We were scared going in because the crescendo that was going on with our Navy and our Air Force, the pillboxes coming at us. We were scared to death, and any GI living today will tell you the same thing. I was not scared. That is bull. We were all scared.
We're going to hear in a few minutes from Major Henry Duke Boswell, who parachuted into France just a few miles behind those beaches on D-Day. Carlo Desti joins us from Woods Hole, Massachusetts. What made Omaha Beach so tough and for a while chaotic, Carlo Desti?
Well, there were a couple of problems. One thing that we haven't mentioned so far was that the one factor that they couldn't control on D-Day was the weather, and the weather was marginal. You know, D-Day was originally scheduled for June 5th, and they couldn't come on June 5th because the channel was a great storm had come up, and so it was impossible to mount D-Day on June 5th. June 6th was marginal, so the seas were rough, the visibility was bad. And facing Omaha, on top of Omaha Beach, was the German 352nd Division, which was a very good unit. And our intelligence didn't even realize that division was there. That was an oversight that later we recognized the fact that we had somehow, it had escaped our attention that this division had moved into the Omaha sector. So you had on the top of the bluffs this strong, well-trained infantry division pouring machine gun fire, mortar fire, artillery fire upon those invaders on that beach. And so it just made Omaha Beach hell.
It was a hell. The weather was a big question mark. General Eisenhower had to decide. He sat down 20 years after D-Day with Walter Cronkite. This was in June of 1964. Dwight D. Eisenhower. Cronkite asked him what went through his mind before he gave the okay to launch the D-Day attacks.
Well, I think just reviewing briefly all of the possibilities you had for a success and what would be the penalties, not only of failure, On the other hand, the penalties of not making a decision and saying we'll wait some more. And I thought the best opportunity now. And I said yes.
And then they went with so much in the balance. Those young men, boys they were called at the time very often, boys going off to war, now turning 90 if they're still with us. Helen in Concord, Massachusetts is calling. Helen, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much. I love your show. So I'm a. My father was a medic, and he was in Normandy and as well throughout Europe. And so I'm fascinated by the, you know, a lot of the history about that. My father passed away, though. Mm-hmm. But I did watch a series, and one of the questions that I was wondering was for Omaha Beach. From what I understand, from what I've sort of read and whatnot, that may not have been as well planned out, or that the worst fighting was at Omaha. And I just was wondering, you know, what, you know, perspective on that and how that may have gone better.
Yeah. Carlo Desti, you mentioned intelligence and not knowing exactly what was waiting on that beach. Of course, communications were harder then. We didn't have all the satellites and all the look down and everything else. What about the planning?
Well, the planning was adequate, but the other factor that complicated things on D-Day was the fact that the naval gunfire that we poured onto Omaha Beach and the bombing that was undertaken was not terribly successful. So we didn't really knock out a lot of what I think we'd hoped to do. A lot of the German sites were very hardened anyway, and were very difficult to get at. So that I think was a major complication on D-Day. And you add to the fact that on the beaches you had these things that Rommel had installed called hedgehogs, you know, which are these giant steel girders that had mines attached to them, which were designed to ensnare the landing craft. You had mines. You had the fire coming down, you know, from the bluffs. And, you know, you look at it from the German side, they're pouring their fire down onto those beaches. And that made it even more difficult, you know, for that invasion force coming into Omaha. So what they ran into, you know, was just a buzzsaw that left Omaha, you know, in question for all those hours. But what really made the difference in the end was the courage of those ordinary soldiers who finally took matters into their own hands and said, you know, there's only one way we're going to get off this beach alive, and that's to storm those cliffs. And they had to find a way up. There were various draws and gullies that led up to the top of the bluffs, and that's where they had to finally make their assault. And, you know, hour after hour passed, and finally they were successful in being able to establish a foothold onto the bluffs of that beach.
I mean, Eisenhower was saying more or less in his message to them, you know, you will have to fight as harder than they'll fight. They're well-trained, they're ready, they'll fight savagely. And you're saying they did all kinds of air support in advance of and during. Here's a little bit again from Cornelius Ryan with the Daily Telegraph then.
Air action in every form supports the invasion, like strafing attacks against Nazi shipping in French canals. This waterway traffic is vital for the transport of enemy war supplies.
Paratroopers by the thousands coming in. Here's one Sergeant Bill Coleman with the 101st Airborne, said the reality of what was going on as they came down. Many died as they came down. Didn't sink in until it was all over.
Here's one of my friends and one of our side, and he's dead as a doornail. And they were a lot of them. There's some of them in the trees and everywhere. And I think the adrenaline was such that you didn't have the normal response to this kind of thing.
Carlo Desti described the paratrooper drop that happened. We're going to speak in just a moment with a veteran of the paratroopers going in there. Where did they go? How important was that? What was the purpose of the paratroopers?
Well, the paratroopers were designed to drop inland to secure positions and to disrupt the Germans so that they didn't know what was going on. But they had to do it at night, you know, and to carry out a night major operation where you parachuted in two entire airborne divisions was simply unprecedented. And complicated on top of that was the fact that our previous airborne operations during World War II had not always gone well. In fact, during the Sicily campaign in July of 1943, the airborne operation was almost a total disaster. And so you had the problem of trying to parachute thousands and thousands of troops from airplanes. The pilots had to be able to find the right drop zones basically by moonlight. And so the challenge that these paratroopers faced and those that flew them was also monumental. And it didn't work out that way entirely. A lot of the paratroopers dropped into areas that they weren't supposed to drop into. But that also turned out to be a plus, because a lot of them landed in strange and different places, and the Germans had no idea what was going on. And all of a sudden, there are small bands of paratroopers all of a sudden materializing out of nowhere, you know, firing their weapons and causing all sorts of havoc.
On that day, the 82nd Airborne came into France, a few miles behind the beaches, before dawn, troopers floating down into the town square as German soldiers shot at them, hung up in trees, the chestnut trees there, one hung up on a church steeple, famously to this day. Carlo Desti, please stand by. We have a veteran of that operation with us right now from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Major Henry Duke Boswell joins us. He was a communications sergeant in the Army's 82nd Airborne Division and part of the massive Allied offensive on D-Day. He was 20 then. He's 90 now. Major Boswell, Henry Duke Boswell, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. And with Duke Boswell today, Don Doucette, a caregiver there in Colorado Springs as well. Don, thank you for joining us with Major Boswell.
Thank you for having us. We're very pleased to be with you.
Major Boswell, Duke Boswell, what are your memories of that preparation the night before of going in?
Well, the night before, we were up most of the night. We had sand tables of the areas, and we were studying those, hoping to... we were one of the few units that did land on our proper drop zone. We were receiving fire from the ground as we were coming down. Every tenth bullet was a tracer, and you could see them coming up at you, and then they would zip by your head, right? Quick, like I had holes in my parachute where the bullets did hit it.
You were one of 146 men in your unit in Sicily. At the end of that tour, how many survived?
Well, in Germany, when the war ended a couple of years later, we only had 13 left out of the original. And of those 13 now, they are all gone except me.
The preparation, you say sand tables, sort of like sandboxes with what, little models of the town where you were to land so that you would know what you were dropping into. You would recognize the terrain.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you describe going across in this huge armada of planes, thousands and thousands of planes taking paratroopers across from many nations? Did you look out the window, the door? What did you see?
Yes. I looked out and looked down. And the ocean, or the channel, as far as I could see, was covered with ships. Big ships, little ships. I think there might have even been a few canoes going. But it was just an amazing sight. And then when I looked up, the air was full of airplanes as far as I could see. There were fighters, of course, that... protecting us, but the cargo planes that we were in, several thousand. And as far as I could see in any way, all heading toward Europe. And I just had the feeling that with this much effort, we must win this war. We must. We can't allow anything less to happen.
Carlo Desti, Duke Boswell was there. He witnessed that. It's hard to imagine looking out the airplane and seeing that. Put the scale of this invasion and those forces gathered here in context for us. Was there any other World War II operation of anywhere near this scale? Will we see this kind of scale of operation anytime again? It seems almost archaic in its vastness.
No, we will never see anything like it again. The only operation that had come close and the largest amphibious operation in history up until D-Day took place in Sicily, and that was pretty big. But Normandy eclipsed that by a large amount. This was the grandest, largest, most colossal military operation that's ever been undertaken, and it will never be undertaken again. The world we live in today, as we know, is entirely different. It's a war. Wars that we are involved in are more involved in small efforts. A war of terrorism. It's an entirely different landscape today than it was in 1944. So I doubt that we'll ever see anything like this again, nor could we ever pull off with the secrecy that we did in 1944 such an operation again. You can't hide anything today for more than about 2 or 3 minutes, you know, without somebody knowing it in this age of mass communications. So what we were able to do in 44 was unique.
Major Boswell, did you come down? You say you came down near target. Did you avoid the trees, sir?
Yes. Our target was St. Mary Glees, a small village. But at that village, there was a crossroad and a couple of bridges that led to the beach. Our job was to jump in, grab these crossroads and bridges, and hold them to keep other Germans from getting down to the beach to help push our people off. This we did. At 4:30 in the morning, we raised the American flag over the town of St. Mary Glees. This was the first town or village liberated on the continent. This flag was the same one that the year before we had raised over Naples, Italy, when we took it during the Italian campaign.
Do you remember what you were thinking as you drifted down in the dark?
Yes, very much. There was a barn on fire, and the Germans had allowed the French out to try to put it out with a bucket brigade. And, of course, this meant that the Germans were awake, too. As you said, some of our troops landed right near the fire and were shot before they could get out of their chutes. Some of them landed hung in the trees and were shot. One of them landed on the church steeple and hung there. The Germans inside saw him, pulled him in, took him prisoner. Shortly, we attacked the church. The Germans retreated, and this man managed to get away from them.
Duke Boswell, please stand by. We are honored to have you with us on this eve of the 70th anniversary of D-Day. The music was cheery. The fighting was not. Glenn Miller's Squadron Song. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hail to the squadron. Hail to the corps. Hail to all the airmen who span the skies before.
We're on the beam to victory, thumbs up forevermore.
So hail to squadrons flying high, hail the men who rule the sky. Hail to the Army, Army Air Corps.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking about D-Day on the eve of its now 70th anniversary, the great World War II invasion of Normandy that turned the tide on Hitler. The boys who hit the beaches are now hitting 90. This may be our last big look together with those who survive. Here, Cornelius Ryan of the Daily Telegraph at the start of that day's offensive, the D-Day offensive.
General Eisenhower at his British headquarters checks the working out of plans. These feature the paratroops, the first wave of which takes off in big transports before dawn.
And here, General Eisenhower, 1964, talking with Walter Cronkite, talking about the tragedy of war, cutting young lives short.
So every time I come back to these beaches, or when any day when I think about that day 20 years ago, I say once more, we must find some way really to gain an eternal peace for this world.
General Eisenhower, Carlo Desti, military historian, joins us today. Major Henry Duke Boswell joins us from Colorado Springs. He was there with the 82nd Airborne, 20 years old, on D-Day as he came down just inland from the beaches in France, 90 today. He was one of 146 people in his unit. Only 13 were not injured or killed. He's the only survivor of those 13. Don Doucette is with him there in Colorado Springs. Jay is calling from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Jay, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say, first off, thank you to all of them, any military person that has served ever, especially the men in World War II. But my granddad, you were just talking about the 101st airdrops and everything. My stepdad's father was part of the 101st airdrop, and he told me he was misdropped. And whenever he landed, he hit the ground, and he was taking the risers off the parachute webbing off. And before he could even get that off, he had a German on his back, and it was like instant hand-to-hand combat right away. And he ended up wearing that poor young man's blood for like 5 days before he could ever find a place to wash off and clean his clothes. And he didn't talk about it very much, but the few things that he told me were very, very harrowing, what he went through. And he ended up coming out of it with 3 Purple Hearts. He got shot in the eyeball. He got shot in the leg. And I think a ricochet hit him in his shoulder or something. He came out with 3 Purple Hearts. And I got to go with him to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. before he passed away. And that was just one of the most moving experiences I've ever been involved in. And
Jay, I appreciate your call and sharing the story of your grandfather there. Duke Boswell, as you listen to that, it must bring back your own memories and of what was swirling around you on that day and the days that followed. I mean, it was hard to break out of Normandy. D-Day was invasion day, but it was by no means the end of the hard fighting, Major Boswell.
Yes, the memories keep coming back. I've been back to France a couple of times, and the memories there just get larger and larger as you remember things that you hadn't thought of in a long time. It became that we just fought from day to day. You didn't know if you were going to live the next day or not, and you didn't really think much about it. You had a job to do. We kept pushing because we knew that the only way that for us to be home safely was either for the war to end or to go home on a stretcher, and that there's no other choice. So you fought day to day and hoped and prayed that you would get through it, but you didn't plan on it.
Don Doucette, you're there with Major Boswell, Duke Boswell. You know him well, but you're from a completely different generation. How do you think about these stories, his experience, what happened in that place and time, Don?
Duke is a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. I feel very privileged to get to hear his stories firsthand. It has really opened my eyes as to what the Greatest Generation did and the contributions they have made for all of us here in the United States and for much of the free world in general, and the liberties that we enjoy, the freedom that we all too often take for granted, we really owe to these men and women that have protected our freedoms and given their all, if that's what it took. So I have a great appreciation that I never had prior to becoming Duke's friend, and I am just very grateful to get to share his experiences firsthand.
Major Boswell, you were 20 then, you're 90 now, you're the last of the 13 who came unscathed and alive out of the war. What do you hope the country remembers? What do you hope lasts from the learning of, and sacrifice of that day when your generation, and I say this with all respect and even love, sir, but when it's gone?
Well, I'd like for the public to remember the sacrifices that these men made. They went in with the purpose of protecting America, defending the world, and they were they were willing to give their lives to defend this. And the times that I've been back, I've been to the cemetery at St. Mary Gleese, where there are about 9,000 buried, I think. And I can think of some of the men that were in my company that did sacrifice their lives. And it makes me want to more tell this story or remind the American public of the sacrifices that these men made. And I'd like to try to just keep doing this as long as I'm able.
Major Boswell, Henry Duke Boswell, we are so grateful to you for joining us today. You make it real for us one more time, a 20-year-old young man coming down out of the sky in the dark on that night on D-Day. Thank you very much, sir, for sharing that story with us again today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Henry Duke Boswell in Colorado Springs. And Don Doucette, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let me go to Keith in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Keith, it's something to hear that voice still with us from all those years ago. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to share the story of my grandfather, Staff Sergeant Edward Kanjima. He served in the Army during World War II, and as fate would have it, D-Day kind of sealed my existence. In the weeks leading up to it, his job was changed from landing on the beach to transporting his fellow soldiers to the boats in England to go land on Normandy and Omaha and all those beaches.
Mm-hmm.
And had he not had that job change, you know, I wouldn't be here to talk with you today. And it's just, you know, those guys in that generation, what they went through was, it's just crazy.
It was all on the line on that day. There's no question about it. A change of assignment and someone survives. Many others did not. Justin in Newton, Massachusetts. Justin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the old adage is that history belongs to the victors.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the American historical narrative about these events. I was wondering what the German narratives are by their historians and how much they overlap with our own. And how much, what their perspective is from the side that lost. I was curious about that.
It's an interesting question. Carlo Desti, what about the German perspective as it's been written on the events of this day in the Normandy invasion?
Well, I don't think we've seen very much in the West, you know, from the German end. We've seen some publications, some of the memoirs of the German generals. But we haven't seen much in the way of the German official histories, although they have been written. But many of them had not been yet translated into English.
Hitler was not prepared to believe it was actually happening, I've read here, that he was slow to send more troops in because he really took the feint of the patent bogus invasion.
He did. And, of course, he was still sleeping on D-Day, and they couldn't even wake him up until, I think it was around late morning, early noon, you know, before they were able to get to him. And there were command issues between the German commanders and what they were allowed to do and what they were not allowed to do. That was of great consequence, and certainly Rommel's absence on D-Day, you know, was a major factor. But we at this point still learn and understand very little from the German perspective about their end of the war. And
there's
I
been
think
more
there's
written,
a lot to be learned yet
there's
on
been more,
our part.
Sorry, I apologize, but there's been more written lately from the French perspective. It was maybe hellish to be occupied. It was also hellish to be under massive attack of this bombardment. 3,000 French civilians died on D-Day. 20,000 died before Normandy was fully liberated. It was a hellish scene of bombardment and fighting that came right into their towns. Ultimately, glad to be liberated, but it was a sometimes bitter experience along the way. We've read recently, Carlo Desti.
Yeah, it's part of the hell of war. I mean, the civilians get caught in the crossfire. They die needlessly sometimes, and they die too often. And this is part of what makes war, I believe, the scourge of humanity. The things like this that have end up happening, such as the French situation on D-Day, where the French actually lost more dead civilians on D-Day than were Americans killed in action on June 6, 1944. So it's part of the consequences and the price of war, which is so terribly high.
And so much on General Eisenhower's mind when he looked back on D-Day. Owen Glendenning joins us right now for just a minute from New Orleans, Louisiana. He's Associate Vice President of Education and Access at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. Owen Glendenning, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
70th anniversary, that's a long time. And those who were 20, like our guest Duke Boswell on D-Day, are 90 now. This generation, many have already passed on, and they will not be with us forever. How do you think it will change the way we look at, think about, talk about World War II and its meaning when those who were actually there are no longer with us?
Well, I think you get to the heart of the museum's mission, which is to tell that story of the American experience of the war. And we're just 14 years old. Actually, we celebrate that birthday on D-Day. But we're all about collecting the oral histories of the surviving World War II veterans, and using those histories to tell the story of the American experience of the war.
In New Orleans, in part because the Higgins boats that were famously used in the landing on the beaches were built there.
Well, exactly so. Our founder, Stephen Ambrose, the historian, interviewed Eisenhower, and Ike said, you must know Higgins, Andrew Jackson Higgins. He's the man who won World War II. And, of course, that was hyperbole perhaps, but it was all about the landing craft made here by the thousands in New Orleans and America's ability to project its power overseas through amphibious invasion.
How long do you think Americans will go to World War II museums? I mean, we don't go to museums of the, I don't know, Trojan War anymore, though we watch movies about it.
Well, I think this is a distinctly American story. America's response to this war, you'll remember, in the 20s and 30s, we were a very isolationist state. We didn't want this. It was foisted upon us. And the American reaction, I think, is just exemplary of the American spirit. We had 16 million men and women in uniform during World War II. Now, only about a million are left. But I think they bear witness to what is worth fighting for. And it was self-determination, it was liberty, and it was freedom.
Owen Glendenning at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Glendenning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Carlo Desti, what do you hope that subsequent generations will keep in their minds from the great sacrifice and trauma of this day?
Well, I hope they'll remember, and I think remembrance is the most important thing. You know, on the bluffs atop Omaha Beach is the Great American Cemetery, where there are 9,387 graves, which are a testament to the sacrifice that took place by American fighting men and women. And I think when we look back and we remember D-Day and we remember the great undertaking, we remember all of the sacrifice and everything that happened, I think Dwight Eisenhower, the man who commanded that operation, maybe his word should be the last word of remembrance. And here's what he said when he came back in 1964 with Walter Cronkite, and he sat on the wall of that cemetery on a very gray day, facing those graves, and he said, and I think one of the most eloquent statements that he's ever made, he said, these men came here, British and our allies and Americans, to storm these beaches for one purpose only, not to gain anything for ourselves, but just to preserve freedom. Many thousands of men have died for such ideals as these, but these young boys were cut off in their prime. I devoutly hope that we will never again have to see such scenes as these. And I think that speaks to what we commemorate tomorrow on the 70th anniversary, and what we should always keep in mind as we think back about D-Day.
The devout hope of the general who led the troops on that day takes work to avoid scenes like those, took sacrifice on that day, but he's sending us another message there I hope we'll take to heart. Carlo Desti, author of Decision in Normandy, it's been wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for all of your scholarship and for joining us on this eve of the anniversary.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, thanks for all of your stories on air and online at onpointradio.org. Go out with a requiem from Band of Brothers. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.